as she was yanked behind Orchid. "You can tell David you killed me," Orchid sneered. "He'll probably name a tower after you." She walked away, dragging the girl dressed in white. As the women were swallowed up by dark, the girl's pitiful cries grew quieter, and that most terrible and terminating of words came into John's mind, over and over and over again. "Tell Lochvovin." Chapter 25. Orchid's Loss. It was not far from the flickering fires and the crash of fighting into a dense, dark hell of wilderness, where the dark and the shadows and the smell of winter-wet foliage caused the girl's panic to rise, even as her eyes struggled to adjust to the deep colors of night. She was cold now, in her thin dress, but she had stopped crying. She could feel the tight trails on her cheeks, where the tears had dried. She followed Orchid through the sticking fronds of low-lying palms. Her feet sucked at the sandy mud. The metal collar around her neck never seemed to warm against her skin. In the distance, she could still hear screaming, and every now and then, a cheer. She had not noticed the coordinated whoops before. Had they been doing that all along? Were the sounds rallying cries from the palace soldiers, or the carnival people? She wondered if Mr. Capellatio was dead. She tried to shut everything out. The screams, the yells, the cold, the scratching underbrush. But she was more afraid here than she had been at the camp, even on the battlefield. And she was more afraid of Orchid than she ever had been of Mr. Capellatio. Or Argento. Mr. Capellatio had killed her brother. Would his wife now kill her? When they had walked a mile or so, Orchid turned slowly around. The moon overhead cast scant light onto her face, but enough that the shining glint of her eyes looked unearthly to the girl, like a rabid animal in a trash pile. She shrank back, but Orchid pulled the chain, forcing the girl's head and neck forward. "We are in this together now," she muttered, and reeled in the chain with her one hand. The girl could not believe how strong she was, even injured. "No," she said, her voice hoarse. "Yes. I hate you nearly as much as I hate him. But we are in this together, little sigil. And as long as you are mine, he will never have his kingdom."
"You don't even believe I am the sigil."
Orchid pulled the girl to the ground, where they sat on a carpet of rotting leaves. The girl felt them sticking wetly to her thighs through her dress.
"He may have misinterpreted the passage. Or I may have. I don't know. I need more time to read," Orchid said. "To study the texts. My books."
She looked back in the direction of the carnival. For a moment it seemed like she might return for them. But then she let out her breath so slowly, the girl wondered if she was trying to calm herself. "I would never get through the fray like this. The chain, the one hand. I am a cripple thanks to you. You will pay."
"Would you rather I'd killed you?"
the girl shrieked. She couldn't help herself. They had walked a long way, but they had not spoken.
"I could have. If you kill me, you'll break the new law of mercy."
"Shut up.
Did you hear what I said? As long as you are mine, he will never be ascendant. It doesn't matter what the passage says or even what it means. He believes it. And so he is bereft without you." She smiled.
"His little fantasy of the girl on the battlefield will cost him his kingship." Orchid spat on the ground and cradled the stump of her wrist. "Oh, not to worry, little sigil," she muttered. "I shall not kill you. Not now. Who would be my servant if I did? I'm a queen. I cannot be without an attendant." The girl looked about for a rock. If only she could get the key from around Orchid's neck. The woman had to sleep sometime. Then she would hit her and escape. The moonlight made deep, ugly shadows under Orchid's eyes. Orchid was watching the girl closely. A new expression rolled onto her face like a storm cloud, one of recognition. Her short hair dripped with moisture and blood.
"Tut, tut, little one. What of your law of mercy?
How can you kill me in my sleep?
Surely you are not so evil.
Where would you even go? Back to him? Into the forest alone?
A young girl will not be alone for long. She laughed meanly. She gasped.
Do you read minds?
Never once in all my life. But I know your heart. Because all people are the same. Selfish, grasping, lustful, prideful. Her voice was sly. You cannot break your own law, though. Right? There is to be no killing. The girl could not confess she'd made up the law of mercy in order to spare herself the horror of deheading Orchid, because then Orchid would kill her. But suddenly she couldn't be sure if she'd made up the law, or if it had been divinely sent. It seemed real now that other people had begun believing it. What would it feel like to be given a revelation? Like this desperation? Wonderblood had ended. She had ended it. There would be no more making heads. No more carnivals, maybe. No more executions. She stared at Orchid. All around them were the wet smells of ferns and mosses, water flowing under the ground, the cries of night animals, shrill and sweet. The fear in the girl's heart began to slow. The woman sitting across from her was without a hand. In the weak moonlight, she could see darkness on the bandage. The wound was weeping. It was likely Orchid would die on her own. In the distance, the girl heard not just the fighting, but the ocean, too, where she had been married only a day before on the barge, before the altar of shells and the phosphorescent fire. Orchid turned her face toward the fires and the far-off glint of the towers. She shook her head.
I should have been king. I was Lois's heir. Why not me?
The girl nodded, hesitant. My mother was a walking doctor. Maybe I can make something for your hand, so you don't become fevered.
You'd poison me just as soon as to look at me, Orchid snorted.
I didn't kill you before, did I?
That's because you're weak.
You haven't killed me yet. Are you weak? To her astonishment, Orchid wiped her face with her good hand.
Was she crying?
The girl was much too frightened to touch her. My books, my texts, my carnival, which I took from my wretch of a brother by my own force. Gone. Every good thing I ever did in my life. Ruined.
Or else it belongs to him now.
Her eyes roared at the girl.
I would have burnt it myself to keep him from getting it, if I'd known it would turn out like this.
Her face closed all at once, as though on a drawstring. She cradled her stump. I'm sorry. The girl did not know why she said it, but it was true. They sat a long time in the wet forest, listening to the distant clamor of battle. The sounds grew dimmer and dimmer, and the coolness swelled around them until they were both shivering in the fall air. Then, after a while, the girl woke up. How could she have fallen asleep right next to that woman? But when she rubbed her eyes, she saw Orchid was sleeping too, her neck bent unnaturally, and her face pinched as though she were having a nightmare. Frantically, the girl searched for the key to the metal collar. It had been around Orchid's neck, but now it was nowhere. She didn't dare move more than a few inches, for fear that the chain connecting them would rattle. It was difficult to see in the dark. The only thing to do would be to hit her with a rock. Several small pebbles were within her grasp, big enough to stun her, if the girl hit her very hard. She grew more agitated as the seconds passed. This might be her only chance. But still the girl could not pick up a rock. At last, she sat very still and let the breath go in and out of her body. She imagined she was a wind chime, air passing through her, transforming into beautiful sounds. She knew she would not kill Orchid. She'd had the chance before, and she had not taken it. She would not take it now. The eon of pain was over. The girl did not know why it was true, but she had felt the truth of those words as soon as she had spoken them aloud, and so had everyone else. They had power. It was the law of mercy. She knew something else, too. Orchid would not kill her.
She closed her eyes and slept. When she awoke again, it was still dark. Orchid's face was inches from her own, the woman's clear eyes, in the shine of the two comets as bright green as glass, for the moon had sunk below the tree line, and the girl's body was covered in chills, still blazed at her. But this time Orchid appraised her with more nuance, for finally she said,
"You did not kill me."
"I could have killed him, every one of 100 knights too," she retorted. "But I didn't do that, either."
Orchid nodded. "Though one of us should have."
"Is he the true king?"
"Yes."
Orchid sat back. Her thighs were muddy. Her hand. She wiped it on her dress, but it did no good. "Of that, I am most sure." "Will we die if we stay here?"
The girl thought of the strange man from inside the palace who had told them the lights were meteors. She recalled her mother saying the word, meteor, but she did not know what a meteor was.
"I care not what happens to us," Orchid sighed. "My texts are lost. My life's work. Lois's work. It's all gone. How could I even begin to interpret what's happened here? How will anyone know what to believe?"
"Are there more texts?"
"In there."
Orchid pointed toward the compound with her good hand, the finger dirty.
"And in Kansas. But those are guarded by insane sorcerers who are ruled by a despot. The Black Watchtower. No one goes to Kansas."
"We could."
Orchid's laugh was hard.
"Oh yes, the two of us, a handless executionatrix who cannot kill, and the concubine who maimed her. We shall save the world."
"I only want to save myself."
Then oddly, Orchid smiled, as though some private thought had cheered her.
"The walking doctors have their maps, don't they? For the safe roads.
You know these?" She shook her head. The maps she remembered from her childhood were as long gone as her mother's comfort, swallowed up by the immensity of her circumstances. She hesitated, though. Finally, she murmured,
"But there are markings on the trees."
"I learned a few once, from an old book."
Orchid nodded.
"But most foolishly, I entrusted navigation to others in my carnival. As to David, one can only perform so many duties."
She shook her head. "Do you know them? The markings?" The girl shrugged. The chain clanked.
"Probably some."
Then she stared.
"Could we really get all the way to Kansas?"
"Others have.
Why not us?"
"You just said no one goes there."
"No one with anything to lose."
Orchid's eyes glittered darkly.
"I have always wanted to see a Kansas cow.
Perhaps those priests on the deathscape could do with such a learned scribe as myself. Perhaps they might see value where others have so callously discarded it."
She flung a rock toward the compound.
"What about me?"
"What about you? You are my hostage. You are my ransom. You are," she breathed,
"an apprentice of a kind.
A sigil, yes, but not what he thought. Not an ornament. A lawgiver."
She bent forward.
"You will be a woman soon."
As though that explained everything. She looked toward the burning compound. "Do you really want to stay here?"
"What about Mr. Capellatio?"
"Tragic."
She pushed back the wet strands of her hair.
"He chose worldly delight over heaven. It's a story for the ages. Not our problem."
"I thought you loved him."
Orchid yanked the chain, but gently.
"More than you could ever know."
They began walking before the sun rose. Orchid had not unchained her. The girl did not expect her to for a long time. A burst of doves from the brush on one side startled them, and the girl shrieked, but Orchid laughed. The way they were going was unknown to both of them, until at last one of the walking doctor's symbols appeared in the shady murk of the forest morning, on a tree trunk, when the sun had risen to just above the tree line, but all the moisture was still trapped below it as under a dome. The mark was small, shaped like a weasel inside a wheel. The girl said,
"I can't read this one."
"Try."
I was only a child when I would go around to the sick with my mother.
You are only a child now. Try.
But it was useless. The weasel could mean anything. They might as well have been stepping onto a field soaked with the disease.
I don't know.
They went helplessly forward, for what could they do, until many hours later they discovered another mark, this time on a narrow trunked pine. Behind them was a flat field with white winter flowers. A mule walked unbridled in the grass, grazing, flaring his lips, and chewing. The girl put her fingers on the mark, a square, plain, and a woman's body floating above its left side, something about the image weightless. She remembered it.
We go left. Right is the disease.
And so in this way they began to make their way toward Kansas, from tree to tree, pole to pole, leaving behind the countryside outlying Cape Canaveral, a myriad of changes to the landscape as they crossed it. Even the ground became more solid, the low tree branches no longer twisted by ceaseless coastal winds, the piles of storm-shredded debris thinning out as they walked. They left the cape behind, the girl and the woman, as they walked toward the center of the world. What Orchid said was called the watchtower of the universe.
We will discover the truth in the texts there, said Orchid as they walked, through tight lips. The truth is knowable to those who would seek it.
Maybe, thought the girl. She wished all of a sudden that she had managed to take Cosmas, the head Argento had made for her, so they would look like magicians. It was stupid to travel without one. The girl still did not know if magic was real, or if her mother had been right and faith was a delusion. She did not know if Orchid would kill her, or if she herself was a lawgiver, a sigil, a concubine, or a queen. She felt like none of those things, and all of them. She was a girl with feet walking toward Kansas. She was a girl who had delivered the world from Wonder Blood. She was Mercy, and Mercy was a woman. Chapter 26 The Breach. Marvel had thought he would have until dawn. In his wildest imagination, he hadn't believed the Outlaw Carnival could mount so quick an attack. He'd barely left Michael to prepare his own flight when he heard, from his own tower chamber, an explosion as the outlaws blew up the water gate. The only point where the wall was not 10 feet thick. When he heard the blast, Marvel had taken a deep breath. Yes, he would probably die now. Certainly. Not even as a deserter or a martyr, but simply a casualty of an ordinary coup. The irony almost amused him. He stood in the black night air on his own balcony. He'd been in the middle of throwing a few things in a sack when the blast rocked the ground. He had been, in fact, holding the drawing of his mother, Nasa Whiteside. At the explosion, he teetered unsteadily, but caught his balance against his desk. The framed picture fell to the ground. His mother. The failure. Pushed to her death by the Mystagogue. Her death would most likely go unavenged after all. He went to his balcony and looked through a spyglass, trying to see a route of escape. The wind was blowing. Water had rushed in over the limestone streets, an icing of water, thin as a cake topping. Below him, the world was awash with noise and flickering torches, screams, grunts, cries of pain. Fighting seemed to have sprung up without warning. The sound of it was both immediate and distant, like a noise one hears in one's sleep and is reshaped by a dream. For a moment he didn't care what happened to anyone, even himself. The outlaws had gained the compound, but were not near the towers yet. They were vastly underarmed, slashing forward only with their clubs and pikes. They kept exploding some substance. He suspected they had barrels of oil, scavenged probably from the same spots where the cape got theirs. The hidden troves abandoned by the ancients all those years ago. When a head guard had come to him for guidance after the explosion, Marvel slammed shut the slot on his door and locked it. They would break it down to get at him soon. Someone would. At his desk, he swept more of his bottles and droppers into a hard-sided case. Whether to take them with him, or to have something to do for the moment,
He wasn't sure. He had already packed his most important unctions. The bottles made a sound like water as they fell together. He could sort them out later, if he was alive. He knew each bottle by color and quality. He looked down on the floor at the portrait of his mother. She peered back at him from behind cracked glass. Such a beauteous and terrible frown. The convention of the artist, perhaps. How she did look like his Allison. His mother had probably never been happy either. It was Juniper who got to him before the others. He called out to Marvel from behind the locked slot. Marvel fairly hugged him with delight once he'd opened the door.
"My God, why didn't you run away?" he almost cried.
Juniper paid him no attention. He held a finger to his lips and whispered,
"Michael is ranting and raving for you. More guards will be here soon. They can't understand why you don't open the door. They think you might have poisoned yourself."
Marvel peered around the younger man into the hallway. A single body, a lion-faced guards, was sprawled at the head of the stairs like a carpet, run through with a pike. Blood had not even stopped pumping from the wound. Juniper's cheek was smeared with red. Marvel nodded, grabbing his bag and stepped into the hall. Only a few torches remained lit. The others had burned out. Juniper joined him, glancing around them apprehensively. His shoulder brushed Marvel's.
"You said you'd pay me 3 times what the Mystagogue would."
Marvel actually laughed.
"I believe I said 2 times.
"That's not what I heard. I've got an exceptionally keen memory. That's how I crossed the continent."
"Really?
Everyone's got a talent," Juniper said as they crept down the stairs.
"How lucky for me."
Marvel attempted to sound restrained, but could not contain his pleasure.
"You know, I was going to have you tortured for whatever information I could get about the Deathscapes. But then I thought better of it."
"A true statesman, you." Juniper regarded him closely in the dim light. "Tygo will be going back, with or without David. A catastrophe is about to unfold here."
"I'd say it already has," replied Marvel.
They took the steps 2 at a time.
"A different kind of catastrophe."
When they reached a side door on the bottom floor, Marvel threw his hood over his head, though he knew it would make little difference. His figure was too well known to remain hidden.
"I have my horses," he offered.
"They're not in the stable. I checked," Juniper said. Even now, he looked a bit as though he had just woken up. He'd found a helmet somewhere, probably on a dead man. He pulled the faceplate down.
"You got any armor?"
Marvel blinked.
"Not here."
"We'll have to make a run for it, then," he replied.
"There's no other way."
He pushed his shoulder against the door, but he stopped and turned, his brow furrowing. His ill-fitting uniform was pasted to his body by sweat on his chest.
"I'll take you back to Kansas, but when we get there, you have to do a certain thing for me."
"What?"
"Something that requires powerful magic."
Marvel almost asked, "What again?" But a crash echoed from the other side of the tower, and he nodded, wiping nervous sweat from his forehead.
"If you get us to Kansas alive, I'll do anything for you."
Then they were in the fray, the clanging pandemonium. They had only to cover a short distance before they could escape through a cart gate behind Endeavor Tower. Marvel prayed under his breath. They drew closer, closer, sliding along the compound wall, their feet wet from seawater that had flowed in when the water gate exploded. Carnival men surrounded the small service gate. They must wait for a distraction. They hid for a long time behind the same cistern that had shielded the outlaw king only hours before. Marvel was astounded at the disarray of the courtyard. How had the outlaws destroyed things so quickly? They had even set up a wooden plank bridge where the water gate had been and were wheeling in more exploding barrels. No one noticed Marvel and Juniper. While they waited for a distraction, Marvel became aware of a wagon, at first far from them, then nearer, until he craned his neck and realized that it too was making for the cart gate, barreling over men as it surged forward. He saw one of Allison's handmaidens in the front, and his heart sank. Michael and Allison were surely inside. Marvel watched in slow horror as a carnival man threw a burning stick at the horses. They reared up and the wagon toppled. Marvel nearly stepped out from behind the cistern. His mouth opened. He took a breath as though he meant to speak, and improbably Juniper heard it, for he turned to Marvel with wide eyes. Marvel opened his bag, fingering one of his vials. It would be easy to throw another potion, to cause a momentary distraction. But then the outlaws would surely come toward them. There was no stopping what would happen. Whatever would be, would be. And yet Marvel did love them, both. He loved them as he ever had, flawed and lost, his only child and her husband, his friend. A painful spasm overcame him as he thought, "In my way, I created this. All of it." The thought did not ease his guilt. He watched the outlaws yank them from the upended wagon, along with their servants. He watched them throw his daughter and Michael to the ground, their faces now in several inches of water. The scene grew harder to see as men crowded around them. His daughter screamed. There was a scuffle, a wallowing of people, a splashing of bodies atop one another, slipping past one another. Then there was another awful scream, much more terrible than the scream of fright moments before. And Marvel sealed shut his eyes, but of course that did nothing. Still he heard his daughter screaming. When he opened one eye, he saw one of the outlaws stepping away from her body, her neck half severed by an axe. Certainly a death blow. Then another uncontrolled howl, this time Michael, who crouched over her body like a demon and held her to his great, wide chest, her head lolling to the side grossly, and Marvel gagged. He couldn't help himself. Her hair down her back wetted on the ends now with her own blood. Marvel and Juniper were invisible now that the greatest prize had been captured. Juniper dragged him forward toward the gate. Did he know Allison was Marvel's daughter? Marvel felt demented. He ran with Juniper not 30 feet from where Michael was lying in the cold, shallow water, half his body above it and half his body below. He held Allison still. Marvel slid with Juniper through the cart gate, onto the plain, into the night, away from the torchlights and the smoke and the guards and their masks and the carnival men with bloody, smeared faces and their piked heads. Juniper led them through it all, as though he had done it 100 times before. Marvel took one measured breath. It was over. He could have done nothing in the end. What would his poison have done, besides prolong the inevitable? They would still have been killed. He told himself that. He must believe it. Juniper walked just in front of him now, his own head swinging from the canvas sacks on his belt with every step he took. "That's the only one I ever made." He had stolen a torch and lit it once they were far enough into the forest. Suddenly, watching the guard's dim form, Marvel felt a cold dread seep into him. The head. He had forgotten about that. Only magicians made heads. But he followed because he did not know what else to do. The world beyond was dark, and they had a long way to go. Chapter 27 Fortune. The dawn birds cheered when David mounted the giant stage inside the palace compound, crying out their morning songs, though the sun had yet to break the horizon. A song of wild anticipation. The new day. The new day. John stood below the stage, far enough away to be out of reach of the blood, though he was still soaked head to toe with blood from the battle. His hands as he studied them. The blood had dried in the lines, forming broken trails, like a map someone had drawn and erased. Tygo had the sense to wash. John looked over at his earholes, the wet hair slick on the sides of his head, and then back to the stage. Michael was dragged up on the shell-shaped stage by two of David's men. John had never seen him look so confused. David bent and whispered something to him, and Michael seemed to agree, his body arranged tightly now in anticipation of his death. He wore wet and dirty clothes. No time to spare, John thought, when there was a new king to be made. Michael was so unsteady on his feet that John wondered if he'd somehow gotten hold of one of the Hierophant's unctions. That would have been a mercy. John did believe he deserved mercy. He moved as if sleepwalking over to the block, and there placed his head on the smooth blackness. A wide silence opened over the crowd. David called out in a startlingly hoarse voice,
"I am the true king. I have taken my seat at the most holy place in the world, where man did once take flight, and where he did leave the world and enter heaven. Today we depose a false king, from an unrighteous line of false kings. Today we are set right cosmically. With this act, we enter an age of mercy. Wonderblood, the rinsing of the world in blood for one eon, is over."
He paused. "After this, there will be no more beheadings. After this, the world is healed, and we await the imminent return." Michael looked up from the block. He had no one to look at. John hoped that he could see him there, watching. Then he realized Michael would think him a traitor, and felt sad.
"How does it feel to be last?" David asked Michael loudly. "That is a fate any king would wish for. That his death might stay the hand of bloodletting, and set free the earth from pain. Rejoice, King Michael!"
Michael whispered, but David called out the words for everyone to hear.
"He says, 'I have been first, and I have been last. I have lived the sort of life that any man would want to live.'"
David clutched his sword approvingly.
"Those are good last words. I will give you the easiest death. Mercy,"
he said again, this time speaking it over everyone in the crowd. An attendant gave him an axe. He had put down the sword. John didn't watch the beheading. He heard the thud of the head as it rolled onto the stage. The crowd yelled. When he looked back, Michael's body emptied its blood out onto the ground for some time, gushing and gushing, and David leaned on the axe handle and gazed into the distance. John turned to Tygo. He had decided he would travel with Tygo to Kansas. They would meet the Mystagog together. They would tell him what they had seen.
"We should go," he said.
"We have to get David to come back with us."
"He's a lunatic. The true king is a lunatic. We must leave him."
Then he saw David pike Michael's head. He thought he would have been sick, but instead he watched it all. The head, the people, the stage, the sky. John D. Sousa stood with Mizar and Tygo before his carriage, full again of all the uncertainty that had plagued him for his entire life. He was, after all, descended from a line of chief orbital doctors and astronomers and courtiers and fools. He had lived his life inside the geometry of his astrological charts. Now he had no guide except Tygo, who was only a man, fickle and lying. And yet John was prepared to follow him onto a dangerous plane where they would surely die.
What if? What if? What if?
It occurred to John as he watched Mizar packing the carriage with bundles of food, a few weapons, gifts from the carnival men, that he was finished with horoscopes. But as he checked the wagon over with Tygo and Mizar, he could not help but wish he had some map for what was about to happen. But John knew that believing in Tygo's vision of the world to come was also him taking ownership of his own. There would be no shuttles. At least not now. The true king would not be returning to Kansas with them. If only he had a few of his instruments. It would have been nice to bring them along. But going back to Urania would be madness in the commotion, especially driving a cart with a cape insignia. Outlaws marauded everywhere, looting. His precious instruments had probably already been dismantled for their metal. He sighed.
"What's wrong?" asked Tygo.
He chewed on a piece of tough meat while he strapped down a few pikes. John noticed he avoided the pile of heads the carnival men had given them, stepping gingerly around them every time he walked past.
"Oh, my instruments. Nothing." "That's a shame, Lord Astronomer. A real shame. Which brings me to a confession."
"Oh?"
"I hadn't thought we'd be together this long, to be honest. It wasn't in my mind. I'm sorry. John shrugged.
Mine either.
So I stole your mirror. The black one.
What? My chip of the sky mirror? Whatever for?
Tygo blinked. So I could have another vision.
You said your vision that night was false. You said you made up Telok Vovin and the rest of that gibberish.
I did. But maybe... He trailed off. Maybe we could try again. He kicked at the dirt, embarrassed. John was amazed.
I told you, I never saw a damn thing in all my life.
But a smile broke over his face as he clutched the chip of mirror. Its surface cracked only a bit. He held it up and dusted it off.
How did you keep it safe during the battle?
Luck, I guess. He rolled his eyes.
Magic.
John laughed, a gush of relief sweeping him from his toes to the top of his head. At least he had this, a small piece of his collection.
How fortunate for you.
He took a breath as Tygo looked away. And for me. At last, they disembarked, Mizar at the reins. John looked up at the sky he had pondered all his life. He could see the palace and the spires for some time. In the sky, those two arcs bending over the cape, drawing nearer like fish swimming toward a succulent water plant, their paths exactly like lines one of his compasses might draw. Just like that. Except they had been predicted by no one. Not him, and not anyone who had come before him, as far as he could tell. They were here of their own accord. Even wholly, perhaps, even if they were not, the return. The cart turned away then, and they went into the wilderness. Beside him, Tygo sat with his eyes closed. Tygo was the failure now, returning to the Mystagogue without the true king. John felt calm. Perhaps all moments of peace were like this, just perilous calms between one catastrophe and the next, for eternity. That these quiet periods could last 100 years, or 1,000, or 100,000, this seemed less interesting to John than those bookends of calamity, the disease on one side, and on the other, these two lights, whatever they were. Moments of unaccountable terror and irrevocable change. That was what changed the ordinary into the sublime. Was that, John wondered, the only real miracle the world could offer men? A reformation of the ordinary, bent as if by magic, by an infinitely mysterious force, indecipherable as fortune? This is Caitlin Davies. We hope you've enjoyed Wonder Blood by Julia Wicker, a Macmillan audio production from St. Martin's Press. This program was produced by Maddie Argyropoulos. Executive producer, Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2018 by Julia Wicker. Production copyright 2018 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.